This is fun! The FU Network!
Near before Zod!
Welcome to the Zodcast on FU Politics, the 4U Network. I'm not going to lie, I'm pissed off. I'm at my wit's end, and I feel a rant coming on. It is time for Andrew Scheer and the Conservative Party of Canada to get serious about a plan to govern. No, not repackaging a Harper-era transit tax credit did nothing to increase ridership, and then to slap the word green on it, well, just because. And a universal tax credit that only 34% of Canadians will be able to fully access that does nothing to address the growing gap between the have-nots and have-mores. How does a Harper-era tax credit for sports and arts help families who have seen music and sports programs canceled and cut and slashed by provincial governments? It is a mere attempt to further along the privatization of these services. It is nothing but a bait and switch. Wouldn't it mean we move from collectively caring for each other instead of asking for what is mine? We have lost sight of the importance of funding our social programs instead of falling for tax cuts that do nothing but erode our ability to care for the most vulnerable amongst us. I'm pissed off. I'm angry. I'm seeing a majority of mainstream media falling for the constant deceit and sophomoric stunts of the Conservative campaign. I'm seeing clowns like Ezra Levant openly defaming the Prime Minister and getting a platform in a Globe and Mail. Stop rewarding this unacceptable behavior that would not be allowed in a kindergarten class and start calling it out. For all the criticisms of social media, we are the only ones holding Canada's political and journalistic class to account. Andrew Scheer actually said this past week that those who have made homophobic, racist, Islamophobic statements in the past are still welcome as candidates as long as they apologize. Well, I make no apologies for my next statement. Andrew Scheer is no leader. He does not deserve, nor has he earned the highest office in Canada. I will fight him with every fiber of my being. Andrew Scheer and what he represents will tear apart everything that I hold dear about Canada. It is time to get your heads out of the sand and stand up. Volunteer, knock and lounge signs, make phone calls, do whatever you can do to have your say, but most importantly, get out and vote. On this week's podcast, I have my new co-host, Lauren Griffith, as well as a conversation with Jerry Nichols. Please enjoy the show.
I am doing good. Neil, how are you?
Oh, you know, it's election season, so... One minute I'm Godzilla, the next minute I'm a Smurf. So, mm-hmm. and I have the colors to match. You know, green and blue and all that other stuff. So, it's pretty. It's been a pretty topsy turvy first few week. Before we do start, I want to say that the word of today is therefore, and the reason for that is your tax credit is only accessible to 34% of the Canadian population or tax filers, therefore it is not a universal tax credit. So
yeah,
that would be my my thing. I've been digging deep through some of these conservative policy suggestions and seeing that it's just complete and absolute bullshit, in my opinion. You know, pardon my language. So, you know, if you decide that you're going to create the same transit, non-refundable transit tax credit that you did under Stephen Harper and throw the word green in front of it, therefore it is not green. It's just a useless tax cut that isn't going to increase ridership. And it's just green because, well, you probably threw a dart at a dartboard and it landed on green. So.
Yeah, that's really good how that works.
Yeah. Therefore, I'm ranting.
Yeah. But therefore, with that rant, I have to agree with you. Conservative tax cuts never work for who they say they're supposed to work for, ever. So, therefore, I am also irritated by their slanderous lies. It's beyond irritating. To think that we're all dumb, essentially, that they can just lie and we'll be like, oh, okay, cool, tax cut.
Haven't you ever thought, though, deep down inside, it's like smelling your own farts, right? People say they don't like nasty campaigns, but deep down inside, sometimes you kind of like to watch the car crash, except for the fact as I get older, this car crash benefit affects me more and the people I love. I just,
You know, they're saying that this is an election about nothing, but I feel it's an important election for the, for, you know, that, that impact a lot of people that I care for. And kind of that's where I'm at right now.
I'll agree to that. It's kind of, it's a fork in the road election, really. We can either really just go with the dumpster fire model that is Ontario and go with that for the entire nation or not. And it is important. This is an important election for that, and it does concern me. So I urge everybody to just go out and vote. Doesn't matter who you're going to go out and vote for, but get engaged, get out there, go vote, just get started. Just
F and do it. And yeah. I'm sorry that I broke your flow there when you're talking about the crayon crew at the Conservative Party of Canada, their comms team, who send these sophomoric childish things out, and it's like they don't care about me. They don't care about my vote. They know that I think they're idiots, and they're not interested in talking to me. And that's kind of like Andrew Scheer talks about building this big tent. Well, there's no place in that big tent for me. And you know, there's so much to rant about, and part of me wonders if they're just trying to distract with this garbage. And 100%. You know, yesterday I was feeling burned out by everything, and then this morning I woke up and saw this tweet by Linda Frum, and I'm just like, nope, I'm back in the game.
Yeah,
whatever that is, I'm back in the game now. And you know, I guess one question to ask you is, how do you deal with, like, you know, like, because I felt really burned out after 1 week. Do you feel that coming on for yourself, or do you have kind of a way you're going to deal with that?
I have had burnout before, and what I had to do, honestly, was just kind of take myself out of it for a little bit, and just honestly kind of avoid it. There were certain topics where I would just have to say, you know what, as much as I'd like to get involved in this and as much as I'd like to correct the statement or whatever it may be, it's not good for me to do that right now, to engage in this when I'm not at 100%. I'm not doing my cause any favors by doing this when I'm not at my peak. And I find when you're burnt out and you keep engaging, that's all you can think about. Like, you just keep at it, even when you're done. Even when you've put your phone down or you've closed your laptop, you're still thinking about that exchange or that idea. So if you can just kind of remove yourself for a little bit of time, whether it be a couple hours, or I've taken like a whole weekend off before, and just refresh. Sometimes I know that you can't do that, like if it's your job or something. So I think that it's important to at least take time, like an hour, to just not think about that stuff, especially if it's your job, right? Because that's kind of unavoidable. You can't have burnout and just be like, oh, well, you know, I'm a writer, but burnout, so I'm just going to take 6 days off. You can't do that.
Well, it's kind of like how I'm talking about burning out right now, when you're giving me these really good pieces of advice, and my eyes are twitching thinking about this universal tax cut. It is one of the, you know what? It's going to cost us anywhere from $6 to $10 billion a year over a decade. That's a potential loss of revenue of $100 billion. And if we're in a deficit, I mean, and we are in a deficit, well, the only way that we're going to get out of deficit in a Conservative government is to cut services, so that each dollar that we take out of that is going to be taken out of the pocket of someone else. So, you know what? I feel like a good writing rant coming on is something for The Guardian. I'm just going to have a spastic fit of like writing. It's just going to be like a rage rant, like no spaces or it's just going to be like a 2 pages filled with just letters. People are going to be, what the hell, man?
Well, do you know, maybe do that as your start.
You can then probably, and then edit it, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I guess that could work.
But yeah, like throw that out there. Like just get all of that frustration out in a writing piece, and you know, it'll be super cathartic. And then yeah, you can edit it once you have kind of calmed down a little bit and let all of that energy out. You can say, okay, you know, I may have repeated myself or whatever it may be, because that does happen in rants sometimes, I find. So, you know, the main thing is, so that's great. Like, I highly recommend doing that, like just doing a piece on it and just having a rant. Because, you know, I'll be honest, as a person who consumes media, and just like an average person, I would really appreciate passion from people who give us our media. You know, if there's something that happens and it's disastrous or it's a huge impact, and you know, something like this tax cut, you can hear how frustrating that is for you. And that's nice, because there's a sense of something. Like for you, it's urgency, like we got to deal with this. You know, for other people, when it's, you know, a tragedy, you know, stuff that's happening at the border in the States, you know, they just report the news with a blank face and they're like, yep, kids have been dying, okay, you know, can we please show a little emotion so that other people will be like, hey, that news anchor's a little upset by that, maybe I should be too. Because I feel like that is that normalization that people are constantly talking about. There's all this terrible stuff in the news and everybody's just, you know, blank face blurts it out. Like there's no passion or emotion behind it, which how are we supposed to take that, right? So I think that the conversation would be better had if there was somebody, more people being passionate, you know, throw a Beto out there and be like, I don't give a damn, like whatever, but do something.
Exactly. No more of these like thoughts and prayers when there's tragedy. It's mm-hmm. I appreciated the way how Beto spoke. I liked watching it. It was refreshing to see.
Absolutely.
Then again, I enjoy the odd curse word, especially an effective curse word.
Yes.
That being said, you know, I think that I'm going to finish my rant. And what are you looking at right now in the news? What is making you ranty or feel passionate about?
Oh, my passionate rage rant today is it kind of goes with actually really what you were talking about, just how tax cuts will end up being paid for through social services or public services. A member of the PPC party, in my riding actually, David Patterson, had on Twitter kind of suggested that maybe public education wasn't a good idea anymore. And that's concerning a little bit. I really believe in public education. I believe that education is paramount. It's a huge investment in our futures. So it really chaps me. He actually had the gall to write an entire blog about the benefits of inequality, talking about how someone who is disadvantaged will strive to work harder to, you know, be at the same level as everyone else. And that's just patently false, first off. And it just, there's so many factors that go into inequality. And, you know, the conservative mindset has always been that poverty is a choice, or situations that a person finds himself in is always a choice no matter what. And that's not true. So to base your education system on believing that deprived individuals will therefore strive better to be at the same level. They might, but they may not, because they are at a disadvantaged state. You know, so that is wrong. And there was another mention. I don't know what he's really trying to get at, but so he had said public school does a poor job of bringing everyone up to the same level and a good job of bringing everyone down to the same level. If you want your children to be mentally healthy and strong, start a community school where you and your children can decide what and how to learn. I do not believe in sending my children to a community school where parents cannot agree on 99.9% of all scientists right now. If we can't agree as adults that the planet is about to burst into flames, I'm not about to send my children to a what would it even be? I'm not sure if you'd call it a school at this point. The community learning center, I guess. I'm not going to send them there where I'm not sure that they believe in science. Like, the construct of how he wants this to work, I'm not sure about it. Like, it doesn't compute with me, and it's very frustrating. Also, for the fact that he seems to be pushing an ulterior design here, you know, with the dismantling of public education, just knocking it constantly, saying that parents can do better teaching their kids when you read through the comments and the parents can't decide between, or they can't differentiate between your and you are, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't want my children to be in that situation. You know, these people, they don't like teachers either. So where are they going to get these educators from? Just random people? Like, are they going to be paid?
But don't you find that conservatives and libertarian types, though, they're into this whole social Darwinism thing, right? Mm-hmm. Where they feel that the worthy, and it's not a matter of it's not poor or rich, it's the worthy and the unworthy. Mm-hmm. And the unworthy are where they belong. And the worthy are going to get theirs. And you know what? The entire concept of conservatism, financial conservatism to me, or what it's morphed into, mm-hmm. is just abject cruelty.
It is.
And it's, you know what? It's a sickening state. And I'm sick and tired of trying to be diplomatic. You know, there are a lot of conservatives I know who I respect, people who have very valid reasons for their economic, you know, I mean, there's solid theory and there's solid fact behind their beliefs. And then there's people who just want to crash the plane into the ocean, and whoever gets out and can swim is going to stay. And that's not my Canada. It'll never be my Canada. Yeah, and this is what we're up against, right? This is the bullshit that we're going to have to go up against.
Yes. And that is a frustrating thing, right? Like I find I don't know who I find more frustrating, because the person who just, you know, wants to just watch the world burn, there's really not much you can do about those people. They are who they are. But I have some people that I know in my life that are conservative, but it's okay, they're fiscally conservative, socially liberal, but I don't necessarily even really believe in that. Like, I don't, because if you're fiscally conservative, all of the socially liberal things that you're fighting for, you're voting against with your fiscal conservatism. So it doesn't really jive for me. But anyway, so there's people that believe in these conservative ideas, and you hear them speak and you're like, but I know that that's wrong. Like, you know, thinking that, you know, that the social Darwinism thing, they just, you know, believe that's how it is. And because they are in this situation where they're good, they're just okay with it. And that's frustrating, because there really isn't convincing them, at least for me, I haven't had success in explaining to them how to have a different perspective, at least, like to just even try to look at it differently. An example, I guess, I was having a bit of a twit-a-tat, so tit-a-tat on Twitter, haha. There was some Kamala Harris supporters that were defending her truancy bill, like her that thing that happened forever ago. She had signed something or was proposing it. No, she did sign it because people actually did get arrested. So she had signed a truancy bill saying that, you know, if kids missed a certain amount of school, then their parents could be arrested. You know, a lot of the supporters were saying that that was just an outright lie and that never happened. And then when you provide them with that evidence, they say, okay, well, whatever, the parents deserve to be in jail anyways for neglecting their child's education. Who's going to take care of the children when their parents are in prison? What is more neglectful? Like, actually neglecting your child for however long you're in jail for. Or, you know, your kid missing 50 days out of the school year. You know, so they can't. There was a lot of people that were saying that their situation was just awful. There was someone who was being, like, taking on the mother of the house role at 9 years old. And this person was defending the bill. They said, this was my life and I went to school and I made sure everything was fine. Okay, but where are your parents? Like, imagine if, you know what I mean? Like, they can't extend that thought process to anybody but themselves. Because if you say to them, you know, your parents might have neglected you, they flip out, how dare you, you know nothing about my life, you don't know me, etc., etc., but your parents sucked. Like, they have no problem throwing you and your situation under the bus, or a stranger, like that kid whose parents might get arrested. They have no problem not understanding their situation, but if you even think about their way of life, they just jump down your throat. I don't understand those people.
Well, I think that's what we're up against, Lauren, and that's kind of what we're going to have to, that's what we're going to have to combat. And I think that, you know, I spent the last few days looking for answers, and now I realized it's just kind of putting out each one fire as it arises. And I guess that's a lot to think about. And you know, I want to thank you again for jumping on as my co-host. It was, as always, it's a pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It was nice to kind of be able to get stuff off of our chest a little bit today. So that was cool.
Exactly. I guess that's kind of the point, right? Sometimes I've called this my own personal therapy session, but I felt very ranty today, and thank you for letting me rant.
Oh, I was so happy to participate in that.
Today, it's a pleasure to have Jerry Nichols on the Zodcast. Jerry has one of my favorite bios on Twitter. That's at Jerry Nick, N-I-C. It says, communications consultant, Hill Times columnist, and one of Canada's top five political minds, slightly cuter than Justin Trudeau. He's a regular panelist on CTV's Power Play and a frenemy to Greg McEachern. Hello, Jerry. Thank you very much for appearing on the Zodcast.
Well, hi, Neil. I'm glad to be here.
So tell us a bit about yourself, your work, and what you currently have on the go.
Well, I'm a communications consultant. I've been working for almost three decades now. Well, actually more than three decades. Yes, I'm that old on political campaigns. And most of that time I spent working for a conservative advocacy group called the National Citizens Coalition. And I was in charge of sort of the national media campaigns. I worked with a guy there for about 5 years. You may have heard of him. His name is Stephen Harper. He left the NCC in about 2001 to take on some government job. So I kind of lost contact with him after that. And then I left the NCC in 2007, and ever since then I've been doing sort of freelance communications. I've done work in Canada and the United States, helping politicians and businesses and other people sort of develop communication strategies.
Yeah, it seems that that Harper guy that you once worked with went on to, I forget what it was. Oh, yes, to become the Prime Minister of Canada. So that must have been, I mean, I'm not going to ask you to dish on anything, but was Stephen Harper, the man that you worked with and the man who was the Prime Minister, did he stay true to who he was at the NCC, to what where he ended up?
Well, he was, in terms of his personality, he was pretty much the same. Stephen Harper was never what I'd call a cuddly boss. But if you did your job okay, you know, you got along well with him. Yeah, he could be tough at times, but I'm okay with that. I'm okay with working for tough guys. I've worked for a lot of them in my career. When he became Prime Minister, I think there was a shift more in terms of his ideology. When he worked at the NCC, he was more of a hardcore, small L libertarian conservative, you know, very much in a Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher mold, smaller government, you know, fewer lower taxes, all that kind of stuff. When he became leader of the Conservative Party and later on Prime Minister, he kind of lost that ideological edge, and he became more of sort of a middle of the road, sort of wishy-washy Canadian Prime Minister, which kind of disappointed me at the time, because I was still kind of an ideological warrior back in those days. My view is sort of tempered a little bit. You know, being involved in politics, you see that sometimes you can't always promote the kind of things you want to promote in politics because it can be very difficult. There's a lot of compromises you have to make. So I would say overall that my experience with Stephen Harper was a very positive one. He taught me a lot about politics. I learned a lot from him. And I like to think I taught him a couple things too. And when he first came to the NCC, he was more of a policy wonk. I kind of showed him how to do hardcore street level politics, you know, how to brawl. And I think he took that with him, certainly when he went into federal politics.
Now, in the conservative movement, I mean, in general, what type of shift have you seen in ideology from, let's say, you know, I mean, as you've been in it for a period of time. So where would you see it have gone from, you know, the end of the Mulroney era to the Scheer era, I guess, in national conservative politics?
Well, I always tell people that there's no such thing as a conservative party. It's more of a coalition of various clans, factions, and tribes, each with their sort of ideological outlook. You have libertarians, you have red Tories, you have populists, you have Christians, you have economic conservatives, and often they hate each other just as much as they hate the Liberals or the NDP. So it's kind of a hodgepodge sort of a party, which makes it a very difficult party to lead. And I think, you know, Stephen Harper sort of led the party with savage discipline, because that was the only way to keep all these people in line and keep them sort of united under his banner, because otherwise they might break out into squabbling. I think overall the conservative movement has sort of moved away from the economic of conservatism. They've sort of moved away from the Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher style conservatism, kind of what I grew up with back in the 80s and early 90s. And it's sort of trending towards more of a populist approach, more of populist ideology, not necessarily for free markets as much as they used to be. And I think that's not just here in Canada. I think that's sort of happening all over the world. It's something that, you know, as an old school kind of conservative, I find a little troubling, because I would my focus has always been in economics, on making government smaller, you know, libertarian ideology, free markets, freedom for individuals. That's always been my kind of stance on it. That was certainly my stance back when I worked at the National Citizens Coalition. But you know what? Attitudes change, policies change, ideologies change, and all you can do is sort of watch it and sort of observe it and see what happens.
Now, you brought up the move to populism. Now, do you think that that's more because of external pressures or internal pressures from within? You know, like you said, the conservative, it's not a party, it's more of a movement, and it seems to be quite fluid. Now, is that because of internal pressures from the, you know, from the various factions inside the conservative coalition? Or is that mainly looking abroad or looking at the United States or looking elsewhere and seeing the movement?
Well, I don't think conservative leaders, both in Canada and the United States, Republicans and conservatives, have done a very good job in selling sort of a conservative ideology. They often will, you know, sort of move to the left. If they think that's more popular. They'll sometimes sell out their principles. And I think that has disillusioned a lot of small C conservatives, a lot of people in the conservative movement. And they're saying, hey, you're no longer standing for what I believe in. You're selling out. You're becoming too left wing. You're becoming too establishment. And that creates a sort of a fertile ground for a sort of a populist style movement to emerge. Because what populism really is, I think anyway, is a sense of resentment, a sense that the institutions, the establishment doesn't care about us anymore. And I think for a lot of Republicans and maybe for some conservatives in Canada, they're getting the sense that the conservative establishment doesn't care about them anymore. They care more about going to their fancy parties in Washington or Ottawa than they do about what grassroots people really think about. And as long as you have that kind of attitude, then there's always a danger that there might be some kind of a populist outbreak. You know, people rebelling against the establishment, not only the establishment at large, but the establishment within their own parties. And I think that's what largely what Donald Trump was. A lot of Republicans were sort of supporting Trump because that was a way to stick it to the Republican establishment. I think we saw that, you know, sort of attitude in Toronto as well with Rob Ford. I think a lot of people voted for him to sort of stick it to the Toronto establishment. So I think it's largely the fault, I think, for conservative leaders for not saying, hey, you know, we're really standing up for conservative values. We're standing up for conservative ideology and conservative ideals. And I think if they started doing that again, if they started, we need a leader who'll stand up for those ideals, who'll stand up for those philosophies, and maybe people will go back to sort of the mainstream and the populist movement will fade a little bit. But I'm not sure. I don't see any sign of that happening in the United States. I don't see any signs of that happening in Europe, at least yet. Here in Canada, has not really taken off. It'll be interesting to see what happens if Andrew Scheer loses this election, because he's kind of a pro-establishment guy. He's not really a rock-the-boat guy. He's sort of a get-along-to-go-along guy. And if he loses, I think a lot of conservatives will say that, hey, aha, you see, we were too weak. We need a stronger leader. We need more of a Donald Trump kind of a leader.
Now, are there any conservative politicians in Canada right now that you can see? Like, I mean, let's set Scheer aside right now. I mean, the election isn't written. The results aren't written. Nothing is for certain. But let's just say hypothetically that they're looking for that type of leader. Who do you see in Canada that can fit that bill?
It's hard for me to answer that question, Neil. You know, when I was working in the States in 2010, I could sense that there was a growing resentment within the Republican ranks against the establishment. I was working with Republicans. I was in a Republican campaign. So I saw it firsthand. And I knew that somebody might come down the road who would take advantage of that, some political entrepreneur who would exploit that feeling and become leader. Never in a million gajillion years did I ever think that would be Donald Trump that would do that. And he did. He sort of came out of nowhere and became the sort of champion of the Republican Party. So I cannot predict, you know, if there is some kind of populist champion in Canada, I don't know who it would be. I don't really see anybody right now emerging to take on that mantle, but you never know where they'll come from. You never know.
Now, having worked for a number of campaigns, for a number of leaders in a number of roles, I'd like you to maybe give me your assessment of each of the leaders vying, you know, to become prime minister right now in Canada.
Well, I'll start with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. I think he got elected in 2015 basically on the basis of his personality. People thought he was cute. People thought he was adorable. People thought he was kind of a different kind of politician. And that's why he won. He was basically a care bear, right? That's how he won. 2019, he's going to be a different kind of candidate. He's still going to be a care bear. He's still going to try to do the Trudeau adorable thing. But this time, the care bear is going to have six-inch fangs. He's going to be a little more aggressive. He's going to start going after Andrew Scheer. He is going to be waging what I would call a bad versus bad campaign. In other words, with all the things which have happened to Trudeau over the past couple of years, but mainly the SNC scandal, he's got to have to sort of embrace the fact that he's got flaws. And he's going to have to say to people, look, I may be bad. I may be made mistakes, but Andrew Scheer's worse. He's badder than I am. So I think we're going to see that kind of campaign from the Liberals, and we already are seeing that kind of campaign from the Liberals. As far as Andrew Scheer goes, he does not have a lot of strengths as a politician in terms of his personality. He certainly doesn't have Trudeau's charisma or flair that Trudeau had in 2015. He's more of a bland guy, boring guy. So far, the conservative strategy has been to kind of embrace that blandness and boringness. But he also doesn't seem to have Harper's gravitas. He doesn't come across as a deep thinker. He does not have sort of Donald Trump's energy. He does not have Donald Trump's sort of celebrity name. He doesn't have the background like Donald Trump said. I'm a real estate developer. I'm a businessman. I'm a successful businessman. You know, vote for me. I can handle the economy. Scheer doesn't have that kind of background. He's just sort of a lifetime politician. So in terms of marketing, he's a real difficult candidate for the Conservatives. So that's why, in my view, the Conservatives cannot highlight Scheer as their champion. They cannot say vote for Scheer because he's great. I think what they have to do is they have to, like the Liberals, they have to try to degrade the opposition. And I think they're going to do that. I think they're going to try to degrade Trudeau as much as they can. And also, they have to find some kind of really sort of issue that galvanizes people. Maybe that's the carbon tax. I don't know. That's what pollsters should be finding out. They should be finding out some issue that Scheer can do it, because he's not going to win on his personality alone. Jagmeet Singh, almost irrelevant for the last couple of years. His party, as from what I've read in the media, has very little money, which makes it difficult to get your message out. As someone once said, you can't change the world if you can't pay the rent. So I think they are really behind the eight ball. I think Jagmeet Singh has potential charisma. Whether or not he can take advantage of that and sort of catch fire during the election, I highly doubt it. I think the NDP is really going to have a hard time in this election. Then you have Elizabeth May, Green Party leader. Up until now, she's always sort of had a reputation of being a quirky but lovable politician. I think a lot of people liked her because she was sort of an anti-politician, and also she was promoting a really trendy cause, the environment. But this time, it's a little bit different. This time, people are taking her seriously. Some polls are indicating that she could draw support away from the Liberals, which is a real threat to Justin Trudeau, who needs just about every vote he can get. So I think she could come under fire. What I think will be interesting to see is if Trudeau goes after her. He might start branding her as an irresponsible environmentalist who will sacrifice the economy in terms of saving the environment. So we'll see if May can fight back. And I think that's the main thing about her. We don't really know if she can scrap. We don't really know if she can handle herself in a fight, because she's never had to. And I guess that leaves us with Maxime Bernier. I think Bernier is an interesting candidate. I think he's trying to be that kind of populist voice in Canada. But, like the NDP, he has no money. He also has no organization. He doesn't really have, I think, the political instincts that you would need to be that kind of outsider politician. So, I think that's basically what we're going to see in this election. I think the big question is, there's two questions. Are the Liberals vulnerable this time? I think the answer is yes, they are vulnerable. The second question is, can the Conservatives take advantage of that? Do they have the skill and the savvy to beat Trudeau? That I don't know. That's still an open question.
Now, when looking at some of the various races, are there any like bellwether ridings or bellwether like races that you've been paying attention to? Like myself, I've been really interested in the Lisa Raitt versus out of Vancouver and in Milton race, but are there any ones that you're kind of looking at as a measure of what the electorate's thinking or feeling right now?
I'm more looking more of a macro picture in terms of where the Liberals and the Conservatives will have battlegrounds in the provinces. I think Trudeau is finished. I think the Liberals are finished anywhere between British Columbia and Ontario. I think that's all probably going to go back to the Tories. I think the battleground will be Ontario and Quebec. And Quebec, to me, the wild card is the Bloc Québécois. Will they reemerge? Will they sort of rise from the dead and maybe soak up votes away from the Liberals? I think that would be a very advantageous to the Conservatives if that were to happen. Ontario, I think that's the battleground. I think Ontario is the battleground. What will happen there? I think that will decide the election. And we'll see. I mean, the polls, you know, depending which poll you look at, you see various numbers out there. And I always take public opinion polls with a grain of salt. But I think that's where it's going to be won or lost in this election.
How do you see the Ford factor playing into this?
I think the media is overstating what Ford dynamic will do in this election. I think it will have some impact because people can't distinguish between provincial and federal parties. So if they're mad at the Ontario Tories, they'll also be mad at the federal Tories, and which could be a problem for Scheer. And I think the real problem for Scheer in terms of Ford is that Ford has shown himself in a lot of ways to be incompetent as a leader. So it's not ideology, it's incompetence. And I think competence is always something the Tories always sort of talk about when they want to displace the Liberals, right? We're not going to really change too much, say the Conservatives, but we're going to run things more efficiently because we're Conservatives. And I think that usually works because people's default position is, Conservatives maybe have a lot of problems, but yeah, they're better managers than the Liberals. That's always been kind of a default position for a lot of voters. But Ford kind of throws that into question. And they say, oh, Conservatives aren't as competent as we thought they were, so maybe we won't vote for Scheer. So I think that is a problem. But I don't think it's an overwhelming problem for Scheer. I think he can recover from that just through his own communication strategy, just the way he communicates, just the way he promotes his own vision. And even if Ford isn't liked, we should remember that, you know, a lot of people don't like Trudeau either. And that's when I talked about this is going to be a bad versus bad kind of race. There are no good guys in it. Each side is going to try to say the other guy is worse than me. That's kind of a negative, nasty campaign, but I think that's where we're heading.
I think we've been able to see the fact that it's going to be a nasty campaign from a while away. Now, I volunteered. I've never been as involved in kind of, I guess, the inside of a political campaign as you, but I found already within the first week or so of this campaign for it to be almost overwhelming at times with all the information coming out, the negativity. How do you keep yourself? I mean, is it? I know some people are political animals. People I know who work in campaigns that they love it. They love the whirlwind. They love the chaos. How do you keep yourself sane in times like this?
You don't. I think I lost my sanity a long time ago. And I'll tell you, I love negative campaigning. I love it. I was recruited to work in the States precisely because I can brawl. And I'll tell you, when you're with a bunch of other communication strategists or political strategists or consultants, they're all straining at the leash all the time. They want to go negative. And sometimes that makes sense going negative. Sometimes it doesn't. And I think that's the mark of a good strategist, is when you have strategic forethought, because sometimes going negative can be the wrong way to go, or it won't work. And sometimes going positive is the right way to go. But just, you know, going negative is so much more fun, right? It's so much more, it's you really want to get that reputation of being a gunslinger. But I think you also have to remember, Neil, that a lot of the people who like it and revel in it, and you see them all on Twitter, they don't represent the population as a whole. This is why you got to be careful. And I see a lot of journalists make the mistake. They'll see a bunch of people saying nasty things on Twitter, and they'll think, oh, this is what the population is, terribly divided, is terribly polarized. Well, no, the population on Twitter is polarized and divided, but they don't necessarily represent a cross-section of the public. And in fact, a lot of people aren't even really paying attention at all to what's going on in politics. I had a political consultant friend of mine. He was also my mentor. He used to say to me that whenever you go into a campaign, you have to understand that most people don't know anything about anything, and you basically have to sort of tell people things they don't want to hear, or they don't care about, or they don't want to know about. And that's the tricky part about politics, is how do you communicate things to people who aren't really paying all that much attention? And a lot of this negative stuff that's going on right now, a lot of it's just white noise for a lot of people. A lot of it's just about mobilizing and galvanizing and energizing your own base.
Have you ever thought of yourself throwing your hat in the political ring or running at any point?
Oh God, no. I would be a terrible candidate for a lot of reasons, mainly because I have a huge paper trail. In my life, I've been around for a long time, and I've taken a lot of positions, a lot of issues. And if you ever wanted to throw anything against me, you have a lot of ammunition. And also, I prefer the back room kind of part of politics. It's interesting. It's like a game. It's tactics. It's strategy. It's an intellectual challenge, which I find more interesting than actually going out there and waving a flag in front of people. It can be fun, and that can be kind of addictive.
I had a friend who'd worked on a number of campaigns, and he once told me that he'd rather be a hammer than a nail. So I loved that statement, and it kind of made me kind of realize that, myself, I'm just establishing my paper trail. I think I've been pretty successful at it so far. So I don't see myself doing that, but I guess kind of in closing, I guess what would be a highlight and a low light of the campaign as you see it so far?
Well, I think the highlight was the media bus ramming into the Liberal plane, because that was, that was perfect symbolism, or if you believe in omens, that would be a perfect omen. And it was kind of funny. And if I was a conservative, I'd make a lot of hay out of that. The low point, well, you know what? I guess I could say all this stuff that's going on about social media backgrounds and stuff like that. On the one level, you look at that and you say, does this really matter? This is kind of stupid. But you know what? That's politics. And that's the way politics is done. Politics has always been vicious. It's always been a brawl. It's always been, kind of nasty. The only thing that's different now is that the nastiness and the viciousness is taking on is going through a new media outlet, through social media. That's the only difference. So I really can't say that's a low light. I'm sort of a positive person, so I'm just gonna say, what we're seeing now is just politics being politics. And, that's the kind of stuff the media likes. That's the kind of stuff pundits like. Most people are, as I said, aren't really paying that much attention to it. And in fact, most people won't pay attention to politics, to what's going on, probably to a week before the election. And so that's when we'll see all the real fun stuff happening.
I've often thought last in a 2015 election for me that the people who aren't as politically engaged as I am really started paying attention in Thanksgiving. That's when I found the curiosity, the questions, people like messaging me on Facebook or text messaging, asking me questions about various party positions. So I have a feeling that we may see a similar type thing again. Jerry, it's been a pleasure having you on. Even though we do sit on opposite sides of the ideological divide, I've always found that my greatest education in politics have been getting to know people who have differing political views than myself. I enjoy your writing, and I enjoy you on CTV Power Play. It's an absolute pleasure having you on.
Well, thanks, Neil. I'm glad to hear that, because that's a rarity these days for people who try to reach across and talk to people from the other side. All too often now, we've become a society where we divide ourselves into tribes, and the other tribe is absolutely evil. And that, to me, is not a healthy way for a democracy to be.
No, me neither. And to be honest with you, and I've said to friends who are entering politics, is to have friends that are conservatives, because you'll have your best debates, you'll become a better debater, you're going to learn how to articulate your positions better and faster, you're going to think faster on your feet when it comes to political discussions. And at the end of the day, I asked, maybe I'm one of those better angels of our nature type people, but I feel that at the end of the day, we're all Canadians, and we may differ on how to get there, but I think for the most part, we all want the same goal. So thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil.
Thank you again for tuning into the Zodcast. In closing tonight, I'd like to read a little story. It's something that's always brought me comfort. And I think in the middle of an election, when we're talking about tax cuts and where we should spend our money, I think it's more important than ever. So this guy's walking down the street when he falls in a hole. The walls are so steep that he cannot get out. A doctor passes by and the guy shouts out, "Hey, can you help me out?" The doctor writes a prescription, throws it down a hole, and moves on. Then a priest comes along and the guy shouts up, "Father, I'm down in this hole, can you help me out?" The priest writes out a prayer, throws it down the hole, and moves on. Then a friend walks by. "Hey Joe, it's me, can you help me out?" And the friend jumps in the hole. And our guy says, "Are you stupid? Now we're both down here." And the friend says, "Yeah, but I've been down here before and I know the way out." At the end of the day, we have to remember that regardless of what happens in this election, that besides staying engaged, besides voting, that we have to remember, each of us, that we're all Canadians. That regardless of what the methods that we use, we have to ensure that we are acting in the best interest of our neighbors and the people around us. So thank you for bearing with me. Thank you for listening to the show. Thank you to Lauren and to Jerry Nichols for appearing on it. As always, you can reach me on Twitter at That's Mr. Neil. For any compliments, any suggestions, if you have any complaints, you can reach me on Twitter. My name is Ezra Levant. That's at Ezra Levant. Thank you very much for listening.
Nero before Zod!
This is fun! The FU Network!